Part 4. Stars. My son, remember the chains, when gold ruled with iron reins. We roared and twisted and screamed for hours, a veil of better dreams. Io of Lycos. Chapter 50. Thunder and Lightning. The Sword Armada is shattered, more than half destroyed. A quarter seized by my ships, the remainder fled with Antonia, or in little ragged bands, rallying around the remaining praetors to sprint for the core. I sent Thraxa and her sisters in fast-moving corvettes out under Victor's command to reel Antonia in and recapture Cavax, who was captured by Antonia's forces while attempting to board the Pandora. I asked Severo to go with Victra, thinking to keep the two of them together, but he went to her ship, then returned a half hour before it departed, wrathful and quiet, refusing to discuss whatever it was that transpired. For her part, Mustang is beside herself with worry for Cavax, though she makes a brave face. She'd lead the rescue mission herself if she weren't needed in the main fleet. We make repairs where we can, to make the ships fit for travel. We scuttle the ships we can't save and search the naval debris for survivors. A tentative alliance exists between the Rising and the Moon Lords, one that will not last long. I've not slept since the battle 2 days ago. Neither, it seems, has Romulus. His eyes are dark with anger and exhaustion. He's lost an arm and a son on the day, and more, so much more. Neither one of us could risk meeting in person, so all we have left between us is this hollow conference. As promised, you have your independence, I say. And you have your ships, he replies. Marble columns stretch up behind him, carved with Ptolemaic effigies. He's on Ganymede, in the Hanging Palace, the heart of their civilization. But they will not be enough to defeat the core. The Ash Lord will be waiting for you. I hope so. I have plans for his master. Do you sail on Mars? Perhaps. He allows a thoughtful silence. There's one thing I find curious about the battle. Of all of the ships my men boarded, not one nuclear weapon over 5 megatons was found, despite your claims, despite your evidence. My men found plenty enough, I lie. Come aboard if you doubt me. It's hardly curious that they would store them on the Colossus. Roke would want to keep them under tight watch. We're only lucky that I managed to take the bridge when I did. Docks can be rebuilt, lives cannot. Did they ever have them? Romulus asks. Would I risk the future of my people on a lie? I smile without humor. Your moons are safe. You define your own future now, Romulus. Do not look the gift horse in the mouth. Indeed, he says, though he sees through the lie now, knows he was manipulated. But it is the lie he must sell to his own people if he wants peace. They cannot afford to go to war with me now, but their honor would demand it if they knew what I'd done. And if they went to war with me, I would likely win. I have more ships now. But they'd hurt me bad enough to ruin my real war against the core. So Romulus swallows my lies, and I swallow the guilt of leaving hundreds of millions in slavery and personally signing the death warrants of thousands of sons of Ares to Romulus's police. I gave them warning, but not all will escape. I would like your fleet to depart before end of day, Romulus says. It will take 3 days to search the debris for our survivors, I say. We will leave then. Very well. My ships will escort your fleet to the boundaries we agreed upon. When your flagship crosses into the asteroid belt, you may never return. If one ship under your command crosses that boundary, it will be war between us. I remember the terms. See that you do. Give my regards to the Corps. I'll certainly give yours to the sons of Ares you leave behind. He terminates the signal. We depart 3 days after my conference with Romulus, making additional repairs as we travel. Welders and repairmen dot hulls like benevolent barnacles. Though we lost more than 25 capital ships during the battle, we've gained over 70 more. It is one of the greatest military victories in modern history. But victories are less romantic when you're cleaning your friends off the floor. It's easy to be bold in the moment, because all you have is what you can process. See, smell, feel, taste. And that's a very small amount of what is. But afterward, when everything decompresses and uncoils bit by bit, and the horror of what you did and what happened to your friends hits you, it's overwhelming. That's the curse of this naval war. You fight, then spend months waiting, engaged only by the tedium of routine. Then you fight again. I've not yet told my men where we sail. They don't ask me themselves, but their officers do, and again I give them the same answer. Where we must. The core of my army is the sons of Ares, and they are experienced in hardship. They organize dances and gatherings and force jubilation down war-weary throats. It seems to take. Men and women whistle in the halls as we distance ourselves from Jupiter. They sew unit badges onto uniforms and paint star shells in wild colors. There's a vibrancy here, different from the cold precision of the Society Navy. Still, they keep mostly to their color, blending only when assigned to do so. It's not as harmonious as I thought it would be, but it's a start. I feel disconnected from it all, even as I smile and lead as best I know. I killed 10 men in the corridors, killed another 13,000 of my own when we destroyed the docks. Their faces don't haunt me, but that feeling of dread is hard to lose. We have not yet been able to contact the Sons of Ares. Communications are blacked out across all channels, which means Nerol succeeded in destroying the relays, as he promised. Gold and Red are just as blind now. I give Roke the burial he would have wanted, not in the soil of some foreign moon, but in the sun. His casket is made of metal. A torpedo with a hatch through which Mustang and I slip his body. The Howlers smuggled him from the overflowing morgue so we could say goodbye to him in secret. With so many of our own dead, it would not do to see me honour an enemy so deeply. Few mourn the death of my friend. Roke, if he is remembered by his people, will forever be known as the man who lost the fleet. A modern Gaius Terentius Varro, the fool who let Hannibal encircle him at Cannae. Or Alfred Jones, the American general who went mad and lost his Imperium's dreaded mech division in the Conquering. To my people, he is just another gold who thought himself immortal till the Reaper showed him otherwise. It's a lonely thing carrying the body of someone dead and loved. Like a vase you know will never again hold flowers. I wish he believed as firmly in the afterlife as I once did, as Ragnar did. I'm not sure when I lost my faith. I don't think it's something that just happens. Maybe I've been worn down bit by bit, pretending to believe in the veil because it's easier than the alternative. I wish Roke would have thought he was going to a better world. but he died believing only in gold. And anything that believes only in itself cannot go happily into the night. When it is my turn to say goodbye, I stare at his face and see nothing but memories. I think of him on the bed, reading before the gala, before I stabbed him with the sedative. I see him in his suit, pleading with me to come along with him and Mustang to the opera in Aegea, saying how much I delight in the plight of Orpheus. I see him laughing by the fire at her estate after the Battle of Mars, his arms around me as he sobbed after I came home to House Mars when we were hardly more than boys. Now he is cold, eyes ringed with circles. All the promise of youth fled. All the possibilities of family and children and joy and growing old and wise together are gone because of me. I am reminded of Tactus now, and I feel tears coming. My friends, the Howlers in particular, do not much like that I've let Cassius come to the funeral, but I could not stand the idea of sending Roke to the sun without the Bellona kissing him farewell. His legs are chained, hands manacled behind his back with magnetic cuffs. I uncuff them so he can say goodbye properly, which he does, leaning to kiss Roke farewell on the brow. Severo, pitiless even now, slams shut the metal lid after Cassius is done. Like Mustang, the little gold came for me, in case I needed him. He has no love for the man, no heart for someone who betrayed me and Victra. Loyalty is everything to him. And, in his mind, Roke had none. So too with Mustang. Roke betrayed her as readily as he betrayed me. He cost her a father, and though she can understand Augustus was not the best of men, he was her father nonetheless. My friends wait for me to say something. There's nothing I can say that will not anger them, so, as Mustang recommended, I spare them the indignity of having to listen to compliments about a man who signed their death warrants, and instead recite the most relevant lines of one of his old favourites. Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages. Thou thy worldly task hast done, home art gone, and ta'en thy wages. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust. Per aspera ad astra, my golden friends whisper, even Severo. And with a press of a button, Roke disappears from our lives to begin his last journey to join Ragnar and generations of fallen warriors in the sun. I remain behind. The others leave. Mustang lingers with me, eyes following Cassius as he's escorted away. What are your plans for him? She asks me when we're left alone. I don't know, I say, angry she would ask that now. Darrow, are you all right? Fine. I just need to be alone right now.
Okay.
She doesn't leave me. Instead, she steps closer.
It's not your fault.
I said I want to be alone.
It's not your fault.
I look over at her, angry she won't leave. But when I see how gentle her eyes are, how open to me they are, I feel the tension in my ribs release. The tears come unbidden, streaking down my cheeks.
It's not your fault,
she says, pulling me close as I feel the first sob rattle my chest. She wraps her arms around my waist and puts her forehead into my chest.
It's not your fault.
Later that night, my friends and I have supper together in the stateroom I've inherited from Roke. It's a quiet affair. Even Severo doesn't have much to say. He's been quiet since Victra left, something gnawing in the back of his mind. The trauma of the past few days weighs heavy on all of us. But these few men and women know where we travel, and it's that knowledge that adds even more weight than the regular soldier carries. Mustang wants to stay behind with me, but I don't want her to. I need time to think. So I quietly click the door shut behind her. I am alone. Not just at the table in my suite, but in my grief. My friends came to Roke's funeral for me, not him. Only Sephi was kind about his passing, because over the course of our journey to Jupiter, she learned of Roke's prowess in battle, and so respected him in a pure way the others can't. Still, of my friends, only I loved Roke as much as he deserved in the end. The Imperator's stateroom still smells like Roke. I leaf through the old books on his shelves. A piece of blackened ship metal floats in a display case. Several other trophies hang on the wall. Gifts from the Sovereign, for heroism at the Battle of Deimos, and from the Archgovernor of Mars, for the defense of Aureate society. Sophocles's Theban Plays lies open on the bedside. I've not changed the page. I've not changed anything. As if by preserving the room, I can keep him alive, a spirit in amber. I lie down to sleep, but can only stare at the ceiling. So I rise and pour three fingers of scotch from one of his decanters and watch the holotube in the lounge. The web is down, thanks to the hacking war. Creates an eerie feeling being disconnected from the rest of humanity. So I search the old programs on the ship's computer, skimming through vids of space pirates, noble golden knights, obsidian bounty hunters, and a troubled violet musician on Venus, till I find a menu with recently played vids catalogued. The most recent dates to the night before the battle. My heart thumps heavily in my chest as I sort through the vids. I look over my shoulder like I'm going through someone else's journal. Some are Aegean renditions of Roke's favourite opera, Tristan and Isolde, but most are feeds from our time at the Institute. I sit there, my hand in the air, about to click on the feed, but instead I feel compelled to wait. I call Holiday on my comm. You up? Now I am. I need a favor. Don't you always? 20 minutes later, Cassius, chained hand and foot, shuffles in from the hall to join me. He's escorted by Holiday and three sons. I excuse them, nodding my thanks to Holiday. I can take care of myself. Begging your pardon, sir, that's not exactly a fact. Holiday. We'll be right outside, sir. You can go to bed. Just chat if you need anything, sir. Ironclad discipline you have here, Cassius says awkwardly after she's left. He stands in my circular marble atrium, eyeing the sculptures. Roke always did dress up a place. Unfortunately, he's got the taste of a 90-year-old orchestra first chair. Born 3 millennia late, wasn't he? I reply. I rather think he would have hated the toga of Rome. Distressing fashion trend, really. They made an effort to bring it back in my father's day, especially during drinking bouts and some of the breakfast clubs they had back then. I've seen the pictures. He shudders. Dreadful stuff. One day they'll say it about our high collars, I say, touching mine. He eyes the scotch in my hand. There's a social occasion. Not exactly. I lead him into the lounge. He's slow and loud in the 40-kilogram prisoner boots they've sealed his feet inside, but is still more at home in the room than I am. I pour him a scotch as he sits on the couch, still expecting some sort of trap. He raises his eyebrows at the glass. Really, Dara? Poison isn't your style. It's a cache of Lagavulin, Lorne's gift to Roke after the Siege of Mars. Cassius grunts. I never was fond of irony. Whiskey, on the other hand, we never had a quarrel we couldn't solve. He looks through the whiskey. Fine stuff. Reminds me of my father, I say, listening to the soft hum of the air vents above. Not that the stuff he drank was good for anything more than cleaning gears and killing brain cells. How old were you when he died? Cassius asks. About 6, I reckon. 6? He tilts his glass thoughtfully. My father wasn't a solitary drinker, but sometimes I'd find him on his favourite bench, near this eerie path on the spine of the Mons. He'd have a whiskey like this. Cassius chews the inside of his cheek. Those were my favourite moments with him. No one else around, just eagles coasting in the distance. He'd tell me what sort of trees were on the hillside. He loved trees. He'd ramble on about what grew where and why and what birds liked to roost there, especially in winter. Something about how they looked in the cold. I never really listened to him. Wish I had. He takes a drink. He'll find the spirit in the glass. The peat, the grapefruit on the tongue, the stone of Scotland. I can never taste anything but the smoke. Is that Castle Mars? Cassius asks, nodding to the hologram above Roke's console. By Jove, it looks so small. Not even the size of the engines on a torchship, I say. Boggles the mind, the exponential expectations of life. I laugh. I used to think greys were tall. Well, he smiles mischievously. If your metric is Sevro... He chuckles before growing serious. I wanted to say thank you for inviting me to the funeral. That was surprisingly decent of you. You'd have done the same. He's not sure of that. This was Roke's console? Yeah. I was going through his vids. He's rewatched most of these a dozen times. Not the strategies or the battles against other houses, but the quieter bits, you know. Have you watched them? He asks. I wanted to wait for you. He's struck by that, and suspicious of my hospitality. So I press play, and we fall back into the boys we were in the Institute. It's awkward at first, but soon the whiskey dispels that, and the laughs come easier. The silences stretch deeper. We watch the nights when our tribe cooked lamb in the Northern Gulch, when we scouted the Highlands, listening to Quinn's stories by the campfire. We kiss that night, Cassius says, when Quinn finishes a story about her grandmother's fourth attempt to build a house in a mountain valley, 100 kilometres from civilization, without an architect. She was climbing into her sleeping roll. I told her I heard a noise. We investigated. When she found out I was just throwing rocks into the dark to get her alone, she knew what I wanted. That smile. He laughs. Those legs. The kind meant to be wrapped around someone. You know what I mean? He laughs. But the lady did protest. Put her hand in my face. Shoved me away. Well, she wasn't an easy one, I say. No, but she did wake me up near morning to give me a kiss or two. On her terms, of course. And that is the first time throwing stones has ever worked on a woman, You'd be surprised. There's moments I never knew existed. Roke and Cassius tried to catch fish together, only for Quinn to push Cassius in from behind. He takes a deep drink beside me now, as his younger self splashes in the water and tries to pull Quinn in. We watch private moments where Roke fell in love with Leah, where they scouted the highlands in the dark, their hands brushing innocently together as they stop for water. Fitchner surveying them from a copse of trees, taking notes on his datapad. We watch the first time they sleep snuggled under the same blankets in the gate's keep, and as Roke takes her off to the highlands to steal his first kiss, only to hear boots on rocks and see Antonia and Vixus emerge from the mist, eyes glowing with optics. They took Leah, and when Roke fought, threw him off a cliff. He broke his arm and was swept down the river. By the time he returned after 3 days of walking, I was supposedly dead by the jackal's hand. Roke mourned for me and visited the cairn I built atop Leah, only to find that wolves dug in and had stolen the body. He wept there by himself. Cassius grows somber witnessing this, reminding me of the distress on his face when he returned with Severo to discover what had happened to Leah and Roke, and perhaps feeling guilty for ever allying himself with Antonia. There's more videos, more little truths I discover. But the one viewed the most, according to the holodeck, was the time Cassius said he'd found two new brothers and offered us places as lancers to House Bellona. He looked so hopeful then, so happy to be alive. We all did, even I, despite what I felt inside. My betrayal feels all the more monstrous watching it from afar. I refill Cassius's tumbler. He's quiet under the glow of the hologram. Roke's riding his dappled grey mare away from us, looking pensively down at his reins. "We killed him," he says after a moment. "It was our war." "Was it?" I ask. "We didn't make this world. And we're not even fighting for ourselves." Neither was Roke. He was fighting for Octavia, for a society that won't even notice his sacrifice. They'll play politics with his death, blame him. He died for them, and he'll just be a punchline. Cassius feels the disgust I intended. That's his greatest fear, that no one will care that he goes. This noble idea of honour, of a good death. That was for the old world, not this one. "How long do you think this goes on?" he asks pensively. "This war. Between us or everyone?" "Us." "Till one heart beats no more. Isn't that what you said?" "You remembered," he grunts. "And everyone? Until there are no colours." He laughs. "Well, good. You've aimed low." I watch him tilt the liquor around in his glass. "If Augustus did not put me with Julian, what do you think would have happened?" "Doesn't matter." "Say it does." "I don't know," he says sharply. He downs his whiskey and pours himself another, surprisingly agile in his cuffs. He considers the glass in irritation. "You and I aren't like Roke or Virginia. We're not nuanced creatures. All you have is thunder. All I have, lightning. Remember that dumb shit we used to say when we would paint our faces and ride about like idiots? It's the deep spine truth. We can only obey what we are. Without a storm, you and I, we're just men. But give us this. Give us conflict. How we rattle and roar. He mocks his own grandiloquence, a dark irony staining his smile. You really think that's true? I ask. That we're stuck being one thing or another? You don't. Victoria says that about herself. I shrug. I'm betting a hell of a lot that she's not. That we're not. Cassius leans forward and pours me a drink this time. You know, Lorne always talked about being trapped by himself, by the choice he made, till it felt like he wasn't living his own life. Like something was behind him, beating him on. Something to the sides, winnowing his path. In the end, all his love, all his kindness, family, it didn't matter. He died as he lived. Cassius sees more than just the doubt in my own theory. He knows I could talk about Mustang or Severo or Victra changing, being different, but he sees the undercurrent because in many ways his thread in life is the most like my own. You think you're going to die, he says. As Lorne used to say, the bill comes at the end, and the end is on its way. He watches me gently, his whiskey forgotten, the intimacy deeper than I intended. I've touched a part of his own mind. Maybe he, too, has felt like he's marching toward his own burial. I never thought about the weight on you, he says carefully. All that time among us? Years? You couldn't talk to anyone, could you? No. Too risky. Kind of a conversation killer. Hello, I'm a red spy. He doesn't laugh. You still can't. And that's what kills you. You're among your own people and you feel a stranger. There it is, I say, raising a glass. I hesitate, wondering how much to confide in him. Then whiskey talks for me. It's hard to talk to anyone. Everyone is so fragile. Severo with his father, with the weight of a people he hardly knows. Victor thinks she's wicked and keeps pretending like she just wants revenge, like she's full of poison. They think I know the path here, that I've had a vision of the future because of my wife. But I don't feel her like I used to. And Mustang... I stop awkwardly. Go on. What about her? Come on, man. You killed my brothers. I killed Fitchner. It's already awkward. I grimace at the weirdness of this little moment. She's always watching me, I say. Judging. Like she's keeping a tally of my worth. Whether I'm fit. For what? For her, for this, I don't know. I felt like I proved myself on the ice, but it hasn't gone away. I shrug. It's the same for you, isn't it? Serving at the Sovereign's pleasure when Aja killed Quinn. Your mother's expectations. Sitting here with the man who took two brothers from you. You're going to have Karnas. He must have been a treat at home. He was actually fond of me as a child, Cassius says. I know, hard to believe, but he was my champion. Included me in sports, took me on trips, taught me about girls, in his way. He was not so kind to Julian, though. I have an older brother. His name's Kieran. Is he alive? He's a mechanic with the Sons. Got four kids. Wait, you're an uncle? Cassius says in surprise. Several times over. Kieran married Io's sister.
Did he?
I was an uncle once. I was good at that. His eyes go distant, smile fading, and I know the suspicions that rest heavy on his soul. I'm tired of this war, Darrow.
So am I.
And if I could bring Julian back to you, I would. But this war is for him, or men like him, the decent. It's for the quiet and gentle who know how the world should be but can't shout louder than the bastards.
Aren't you afraid you're going to break everything and not be able to put it back together? He asks sincerely.
Yes, I say, understanding myself better than I have for a long time. That's why I have Mustang. He stares at me for a long, odd moment before shaking his head and chuckling at himself, or me. I wish it was easier to hate you. There's a toast, if I ever heard one. I raise my glass, and he his, and we drink in silence. But before he parts with me that night, I give him a holocube to watch in his cell. I apologize in advance for its contents, but it's something he needs to see. The irony is not lost on him. He'll watch it later in his cell, and he will weep and feel lonelier still. But the truth is never easy.